Welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by designer Patrick Grant, and we're going to talk about his book, Less, and about all the amazing projects that he does and has done over the years, and how he champions making, buying less, and using what you've got. Patrick, welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's great to see you. So let's the question I always start with is, tell us a bit about what it is that you do.
I run a business called Community Clothing. It makes clothes. It makes very good clothes. We work with probably most of the really, really good clothing factories in this country. We work now with about, I think, 51 different making businesses, from yarn spinners to fabric weavers or knitters, to garment sewing, to garment knitting and everything else in between. The idea is that we're making great clothes, but we're trying to sell them at prices that everybody can afford, because I fundamentally believe that we should all be able to buy good quality clothes. And by doing all of that and doing it in this country and doing it in the way that we do it, we also generate an awful lot of social and economic positive impact in lots of communities around the UK that really need work. So we create a lot of work, we make really good clothes, we make them affordable, and, you know, we feel quite good about doing it.
Right. And where did that interest come from?
I think I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in how things were made and what things were made from. And I don't remember a time when I wasn't the sort of person, you know, when I was choosing to, when I got to the point where I was choosing to buy my own things myself, I was always the sort of person that would prefer to save up and buy one really good thing. And I don't really know where it came from, but, you know, I grew up in a house that was filled with good quality things. The furniture that we sat on, the cutlery that we ate with, the crockery we ate from, you know, everything in the house that I grew up in Edinburgh was either bought secondhand, maybe bought new, but had been bought a long time ago, handed down from grandparents or great-grandparents. And I think I was just surrounded with quality in a way that I wasn't really particularly aware of, but I'm very aware of now when I see the sort of absence of quality everywhere in most people's everyday lives. And it just was something that was there in me. I don't know where it came from. I think my dad, in fact, both of my parents were both the sort of people that were not huge consumers in terms of volume. They were considered consumers. They bought what they needed. There wasn't an awful lot of sort of frivolous purchasing going on in our house, partly because my parents, you know, spent most of the money that they earned sending me and my sister to school, so there wasn't an awful lot left over. But I think it was just inherent in the way that they lived. And my granny had, I think, probably had a big influence on me and certainly my mum. My granny had been widowed in the Second World War, and through having decided to marry again and then get divorced, she lost her war widow's pension. And so she raised my mum and my uncle on her own. She worked. And again, she was very, you know, careful with the things that she had. And I think as a family, you know, there was a lot of care about the things that we had. In everything that we did, you know, my granny darned stuff and she knitted, and, you know, we were a family that fixed things. And I don't know, it's just in me.
Yeah. And that's quite an amazing story, because I think we're at an age where, you know, you think about things much more than perhaps you would have, and you relate to things from your youth, which, you know, I suppose when we were growing up, it was a very different world. You know, you didn't have all the stuff kind of available to you in the same way that we do today.
No. It's funny because I sometimes think to myself, would I, if I were growing up now, be susceptible to all of that sort of bombardment of marketing that's going on to young people now? Would I be drawn in by all of this stuff that everybody's being bombarded with now? Or would I have still kind of preferred to buy fewer better things? And I can't say definitively that I wouldn't buy it. I mean, I have never bought anything from a fast fashion brand ever, you know, at any point in my life, which I'm sort of weirdly proud of. But if I was, if I was my 16-year-old self now, would I succumb? And I suspect I might, to a limited extent, because, you know, there were times when you want a fix of something new and interesting. And, you know, I remember as a kid sort of screen printing T-shirts that were kind of knockoffs of kind of expensive brands in the, you know, mid-80s. And I might have just nipped out and bought one somewhere, you know, one of the fast fashion lot. I might have done. I don't know. I don't know for sure. But I think it's very hard for young people now to resist that sort of overwhelming sense that you need to be consuming all the time to be sort of somehow a good part of society. But I think what is really, really heartening to me is that a lot of kids, and an increasing number, are becoming very aware that they are being very deliberately manipulated, that their sense of happiness is being denied them by these companies that are seeking to get them to buy more stuff. And they are quite consciously opting out of the whole idea of consumption in fashion, which I think is a very, very interesting phenomenon, because fashion has been around, fashion as a sort of deliberate attempt to manipulate us into buying more stuff that we don't need, has been around for a couple of hundred years. And it's certainly, in my mind, a possibility that it will become something that we decide that we no longer need. I mean, there are a lot of people with a huge vested interest in seeing it continue. But I think there's an interesting divide. I was actually just reading something about Burberry this morning, and it was talking about the sort of change in direction that Burberry was taking, away from being an overtly fashion brand to being a brand that is more concerned with producing luxury goods. And I think it's certainly not an accident, because you see at the moment, a fairly substantial collapse in the revenues of fashion businesses. Yet at the same time, you see brands like Hermes and Chanel, who are undecidedly producing beautiful and amazing things, albeit at an incredibly elevated price point. Those people have thrived, while those businesses that were pursuing the idea of fashion are finding it increasingly difficult to even maintain the size they're at now. And of course, all of them for, you know, fairly horrible reasons, all want to get bigger. So I think we're at an interesting intersection in the evolution of our basic relationship with fashion.
Yeah. Interesting that you talk about Chanel and Hermes, Burberry. That whole fashion narrative has changed over, since the late 80s, where Gloria Vanderbilt had designer jeans or Jordache jeans or whatever they were. And then we started to see designer fashion that then became luxury brands.
Mm.
What's the biggest change you've seen?
Well, I think it's very interesting, because, you know, we fashion used to be something that was quite small and it was very undemocratic, but it was also not doing any harm. And in fact, arguably, it was creating value for lots of people along the chain. And I think this is a very interesting, it's something again that I've been thinking about increasingly over the last, you know, past months and possibly year or more, is the idea that, you know, you can divide businesses into those that create value for a broad community and those that create value for virtually no one. And I think what is interesting is that lots of the, certainly those fast fashion businesses are creating no value anymore for anybody. You know, the people that produce the clothes are paid almost nothing and certainly wouldn't, you know, put their hand up and say that they were valued in any way. The consumer gets no value because the product is awful. It's not designed with any integrity. Lots of it is just pumped out by AI that is producing replicas of garbage that was produced last year, that was a replica of garbage that's, you know, you're getting into sort of cycles of AI reproducing the garbage that AI produced before. You know, the design, there is no value in the design of this product. There's no value in the making of the product. There's no value in the design of the product. The materials have no value. The people who produce those materials, they see no value. You know, those people farming cotton in parts of India, they're not getting, in fact, they're getting the opposite of value because they're, you know, they're becoming ill from the chemicals that are being sprayed on this stuff. The planet sees certainly no value because it's choking to death as a result of it. The only people that see any value at all in that entire chain of actors are the people that own the businesses. Yeah. And there are very few of those, and they've already got billions tucked away and they don't really need any more. So it seems like an almost valueless concept that we are starting to question. On the other hand, there are companies that do create value, and those ones that I have already mentioned, yeah, I think are part of that ecosystem. You know, they make a product out of materials that are sourced in a way that does create some value. So, you know, the people that produce the wool for, you know, for us or Chanel or whoever it happens to be, those farmers are well paid, those sheep are well looked after. You know, the people that produce those clothes are well paid. You know, we work in factories in Scotland that also make for both Burberry and Chanel, mm-hmm, interestingly. And I think also Hermes, rather randomly. But we know that the people that work in those factories, A, are well paid, they're well valued. In fact, they're highly valued because there are far too few of them in existence and the factories we work with are struggling to find a new generation. The customers, of course, value the product. You know, they pay considerably more than the product is really worth in its nuts and bolts. But of course, everybody coming after also, you know, that product has a value that endures for decades, if not centuries, because I don't think there will ever be a time when somebody isn't going to want to buy, you know, a 1950s Chanel tweed jacket or a 70s Burberry trench coat or a 80s, you know, Hermes handbag or whatever it happens to be. This product has value forever. Mm. And people will fix it and cherish it and look after it. And so and that will create more value because those people can then act in, you know, the repairers and others who might act on it. They make a living out of ensuring the kind of continued use of this stuff. So it's a, you know, it's a value-rich ecosystem contrasted with a value-less ecosystem. And I think that is the sort of divider that we ought to be starting to consider, you know, which side of that line do the people that we buy stuff from sit? Mm. Are they the value creators or are they valueless?
Interesting. So a kind of an off-ramp, is a 1980s Hermes bag worth, I don't know, $120,000 in your kind of...
Well, I mean, that's not a question for me to answer. That is a question for, you know, the guys at the auction rooms and all those others who might come across such a thing. That number, 120,000, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But again, whose was it? What's the provenance of this object? Because again, I think good objects can transcend their original value. I mean, I remember seeing the Sotheby's catalogue for, I think it was the Duke of Windsor, and there were objects that were his or Wallace Simpson's that were, I mean, everything that they bought was of extraordinary quality, but they had acquired an even greater value to some people because of who had owned them, in the same way that, you know, the wardrobes of famous film stars acquire greater value, or, you know, if the Hubert de Givenchy dress that what's her name wore in Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know, ever came to market, it would have an extraordinary value. But, you know, you're creating objects. When you create objects of value, you give them the opportunity to have further value added to them. I think, you know, so much of what is made today, whether it's clothing or furniture or, you know, domestic wares or whatever it happens to be, is made in a way that its value will diminish almost to nothing the moment it is purchased. You know, there is no secondhand market for most of the stuff that people buy today, which is a disaster for everybody. Mm. You know, every product that is made ought to be made in a way that its value lives on. Any value that it has, you know, can either be maintained or, in the case of certain, you know, special objects, be elevated.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I know you talk a lot about, well, we've spoken a lot about fashion, but in your book, Less, you talk about all sorts of things. You talk about furniture, you talk about, you know, the mug that you have or sweater that you're, I mean, that's fashion, that, you know, that's been done.
Well, it's not necessarily fashion. You see, I think, again, I draw a very clear distinction between clothing and fashion.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we all have a need for clothing, but we have no need for fashion. We might have a want for fashion, but we certainly don't have a need for it. And again, typically in my head, fashion is something, you know, there is good fashion for sure. And I think I would say that, you know, good fashion is still those pieces of clothing that sit at that intersection between genuine creativity, storytelling, an understanding of society, you know, skill and craftsmanship. You know, there are objects that are still, you know, London Fashion Week has just finished.
Yeah.
And, you know, once again, there are some incredibly talented designers making clothes that have real value, not just because of how they're made, but because of the thought that has gone into creating them. That part of fashion, I think, has a place. And it's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like any luxury. We can have a little bit of that in our lives without feeling too bad about it. In fact, we can probably enjoy it a great deal. Because again, I think, you know, if I look at the shows that were on, you know, SS Daily, you know, those beautiful kind of cardigans with all that amazing work in them, you know, there won't ever be a time when somebody isn't going to want to own that thing and hopefully wear it. But so much of what is called fashion now hasn't got any of that design integrity. It hasn't got any of that craftsmanship. It's simply stuff to be bought, consumed and dumped. And that feels really sad. You know, fashion on the whole feels like something that is sort of manipulative, exploitative and damaging. Whereas I think clothing feels like something that is embedded with value and care and quality and integrity. And we call our business Community Clothing because we make clothing. You know, we are not a fashion business. I am not a fashion designer. I design clothes. We try to design clothes that again, are great for their purpose, have enduring value, are made in a way that creates value for everybody that acts within that ecosystem. And I think it's a distinction that we've sort of forgotten about. I think the fashion industry has forgotten about clothing as a thing that is perfectly legitimate to exist in the world. You know, there is almost nobody making good quality clothing anymore. There's certainly nobody in this country making affordable good quality clothing, apart from us, I would argue. But it's like everybody's just forgotten that certain things that we wear can just be good, well-designed, everyday, simple things. You know, everything has gone fashion. You know, every high street store, all the high street stores that we used to buy our everyday clothes from, they now sell fashion. And I think they're all missing a trick.
And most of it doesn't fit, aside from anything else.
Well, I think it is designed and conceived of with such rapidity and in such a hurry. And actually, why would they even bother to make sure it fits? Because they're only going to sell it to somebody who's going to wear it once and it's going to go in the bin anyway. Mm. Or they're going to wear it for a few weeks and then they're going to try and sell you something else. Why does it matter? It's so cheap anyway. I mean, half the time, you know, we're talking about items of clothing that cost less than loaves of bread or cups of coffee. I mean, it's, what does it matter if it's rubbish? It's, you know, as long as people are buying it, you know, just watch the cash registers keep on ringing. I think people have, you know, there's a real lack of sort of integrity, I think, amongst many of these people now.
But it's not only about the high street. So you talk about, you know, buying cheap and buying rubbish, but you can also buy really expensive and buy rubbish.
You can. And I think it's quite difficult. I think I sort of had a look at, you know, what brands spend. One of the things that we talk about, and actually we do this little advert that's, you know, all the little adverts that we do are quite successful. But we do this little advert that says, you know, some brands spend more money advertising their product than they do making it. You know, we don't do that. We make the best quality clothing we can make, and we let the quality speak for itself. And we have a sock with a speech bubble that says, I'm just a really good sock, right. In a very clunky, I mean, it's an advert that cost about 5p to make.
Yeah.
And it's true, you know, in our business, our overall marketing spend, that's all marketing, all sales activity, all the content generation, every image for the website, everything that you could possibly construe as being marketing was 11% of our turnover, which is minuscule in our industry. You know, there are brands that are spending, I mean, take Temu out of it, who are spending 150% of turnover on marketing. But there are brands quite consistently spending 40, 50, 60% of turnover on marketing. Now, some of that will create value for the consumer, albeit intangible value, but it's value. Now, how long that value endures, you know, if a famous person is paid a huge amount of money to endorse a product, it is creating value in the mind of certain consumers, but it doesn't travel with that garment for any length of time. You know, that association that was very strong at the point that somebody purchased that item pretty much disappears as soon as, you know, that transaction has been concluded. And so it doesn't live with the product in the same way that, you know, the allure of a well-tended brand, you know, most of the brands that are the most valuable have tended to be built over a long period of time. So obviously the ones that I mentioned and several others. Some haven't. You know, there are brands like Supreme and Palace that have generated real value for themselves quite quickly. But I think that came from a sense of integrity and a very, very strong community. They weren't paying people to say they were good. Yeah. Cool people thought they were good. And I think that's the difference. But there are lots and lots of brands today that arrive very quickly and they are not generating any value at all in the brand. And I think what was really interesting to me, I was asked to comment on Shein's IPO. And interestingly, I commented on it, I think it was November of last year, it was being discussed. And interestingly, it was in the news again, I think this week. And I think when I wrote the book, Shein's IPO valuation, and this was a year ago, was being slated at sort of 90 billion.
Yeah.
Now that number has fallen to 60 odd billion and may well fall even further because their revenues are now falling. But I think what was interesting to me thinking about that was that, you know, there are brands that were built over centuries. There are brands, you know, and some of the oldest brands, I mean, the oldest brands around are, you know, people like Beretta and others. But you know, in the fashion world, clothing fashion world, people like Louis Vuitton, Prada, Gucci, and others are quite, you know, relatively old businesses that took time to build their reputation, and they built their reputation on quality of product. They built their reputation by being really, really good at something. Today, some of those brands are maintaining that integrity that was sort of fundamental to the creation of their value. Some of them are not. Some of them have lost sight of the fact that making something good is a good long-term strategy, and they've sort of followed a different path. But we've seen over the last 20 odd years a change in the kind of time period that these brands are created in and die in. You know, if I look back, you know, if you look at brands, if you look at the fast fashion brands of the 50s, 60s, 70s, Zara, H&M, or Hennes & Mauritz,
there's Fiorucci, Benetton.
Well, yeah, Benetton. I mean, I think the ones that are still around and still thriving today, you know, Zara's been around a long time. Primark, in a different form, has been around a long time. Those businesses, you know, it took them a long time, 10, 20, 30 years to build their business up. Around about 2000, ASOS comes along, kind of changes the landscape quite dramatically, and a couple of others probably in different countries. But, you know, you see ASOS go from nothing to a very, very big business and a very big valuation in about a decade. Then you get Boohoo and their copycats and siblings and others, and that time period shortens to, you know, kind of 5 odd years. And then we see Shein come along, and they built a business in, you know, a couple of years. But the idea that that business is going to have any lasting value, I think, is completely bananas. You know, ASOS went to a 9 billion valuation and is now back at a few hundred million. Boohoo was over 5 billion. It's back at a few hundred million. The idea that Shein is somehow going to buck that trend of increasingly short lifespan when it has nothing within it that gives any consumer anything to care about. What does it stand for? Does it stand for anything? Is there anything of any value in the way that it operates that's going to make me as a consumer give any sort of a toss about it in 2 years' time, if it disappears? I mean, I wouldn't, you know, is anyone going to lose sleep if it disappears off the face of the planet? Is anyone even going to remember it in 10 years' time? I mean, it's one of those where, you know, we've got to the point where it's so easy to create big businesses. All you've got to do is throw enough money at it, buy enough influencers, yeah, spend enough money on marketing, which is what Temu is now trying to do with their incredible marketing spend. But what's it worth? You know, why are people backing these businesses? Because they're empty vessels.
And they just want money at the end of the
that's
day.
That's it. It's always just money. It's just money to create money.
Yeah.
There's nothing good happening in between.
I want to turn our attention to your kind of supporting of British brands. So Norton and Son, Etouts, Community Clothing, Cookson
and Clegg. Well, not a brand, but a factory.
A factory. There have been, so we've got your championing of craft and community and making, and then we've got a whole other world of British clothiers, if you want to call them, Dax, Aquascutum, that have kind of just been left by the wayside.
Mm. Well, not entire. Well, it's not that any, you know. There was an interesting piece that I was asked to comment on for the FT at the weekend, actually, And it was around the sort of creation of sort of fashion brand versions of those classic sort of staples that we used to be very good at producing in this country. And, you know, they are putting massive price tags on essentially sort of pastiches of the things that we used to buy from those people like Akskutum and Dax and others, who've mostly disappeared, sadly. You know, some of those old school guys like Jaeger have been sort of bought up by other people and the names are being used, but they're being used on stuff that's, you know, it's not the same as the stuff that they used to be used on. I mean, Akroskutum, really sadly, I mean, that their factory in Corby, which used to be a brilliant raincoat factory, has gone in the time that I've been working in this industry. I've seen Belstaff shut their factory in Stoke-on-Trent and then run around talking about their Britishness. You know, I've seen Hunter Wellies go to the wall. I've seen all these things that, you know, we used to, again, businesses that used to understand that their real value was in the quality of the thing that they created. And I think that's what's really interesting about sort of Burberry's repositioning at the moment, is they're going back to an understanding that people don't just want to be sold hollow bullshit. You know, they don't mind paying a good price for really good things. And they don't mind paying more than they probably know they ought to because of some of the additional fluff that goes with it. You know, Richard E. Grant strutting down a catwalk. Yeah. I kind of like that. And I'd probably pay a little bit more just because, you know, I want to see that kind of thing happening. And that there is a premium for luxury and the kind of fun and veneer of whatever that goes around it that sort of is okay. But I think you have to think about the proportion of that. You know, if you're spending 10 quid making a product and 70 quid paying for all the fluff, you know, and then there's 20 quid's worth of VAT, you've got that wrong. Yeah. You know, there has to be the kind of real thing has to have, you know, most of the value has to be in the object, not in the guff. Because we live in a world now that there's just guff flying at us from everywhere. You know, we can't escape this sort of bombardment of hype and hysteria and, you know, hyperbole and nonsense and all the rest of it that we get thrown at us. And I think we're just starting to get a bit bored of it. And I feel like that was where those luxury guys were going very wrong, is they'd sort of lost sight. You know, their reaction to falling sales was not to go and make better product. It was to go and to spend more money on different celebrities to endorse it. Mm. And I think, I might be wrong, but, you know, I think that's the wrong way to go. I think, you know, there will always be people who understand the real value of something and making it yourself. I mean, all the brands that I really love, some of them I get to work with, some of them I wear. Obviously, Community Clothing is my own business, and I know that we make great stuff. But businesses that make their own thing, on the whole, tend to be businesses that I like more than anything else. You know, I'm wearing, these are Community Clothing, but they're made by Walsh. Walsh is a brand. Walsh make their own footwear. Trickers make their own footwear. I love Trickers, you know, and I wear lots of Trickers. I wear the occasional other shoe brand. But again, they're all people that make their own shoes. I wear the odd pair of Cleverleys. I wear the odd pair of John Lobbs. They all make their own stuff. You know, Barber still makes some of their own stuff. I wear the odd Barber, but I wear the Barber that they make in their own factory. I wouldn't buy their other stuff. You know, Burberry still make their own trench coats. I wish they made more of their own stuff. I mean, I know the factories that make some of their other things, and they're very good factories. But there's, you know, brands like Red Wing still make some of their own stuff in their own factory. Sadly, a lot more of it is moving away. But the classic Red Wing boot that I've got in three different colours, they're still made in their factory. If you make something yourself in your own factory, there is a care that goes into that object that cannot be reproduced if you farm it out to somebody else. Because you farm it out to somebody else who you think does a good job to begin with, but that's the thin end of the wedge, because if they start to get expensive, you'll move it somewhere else. And then if they get expensive, you'll move it somewhere else. And it will, the integrity of that thing will disappear. And I think for me, the future lies in only making great things. You know, if we could get rid of every product on every shelf of every retailer, virtual or physical, that wasn't good, and replace them only with things that were really, really good, we would do the planet such an incredible favor that it would, you know, it would probably reverse all sorts of the damage that we're doing. You know, we just have to make good things.
You spoke earlier about a lack of skill or finding, you were talking about
a shortage of skill, Yeah. Yeah. And it's a real issue because our business is built around the idea that if we do what we do well, we can create lots of jobs within the British textile industry. You know, it's really interesting. You know, at the moment, less than 2% of the clothes we buy in this country are made here. We spend something like 30 billion quid a year on clothing. If we could get, you know, just 5% of people wearing clothes that were made in this country, you could probably produce 100,000 jobs. Yeah. But where are those 100,000 people with the skills to do what's being done today? Where do those people come from? I mean, at the moment, the answer is, I don't think anybody would know. I mean, those jobs aren't there yet, but we are, you know, as we go along, we are creating more jobs. And our hope is that we can, through doing what we do, encourage others to do something similar and get to that level of job creation. But I don't know where those people would come from, because we've sort of broken all of the chains. I mean, we've done lots of things that are wrong. I mean, firstly, we've created in this country a sense that making things for a living is not a good career, which is just plain wrong. Mm-hmm. We've created the sense that supporting and as government, as a nation, supporting what successive governments have seen as sort of the old world of manufacturing is somehow, you know, not a good thing, you know, that we should only be supporting advanced manufacturing. And in policymakers' heads, advanced manufacturing is the manufacturing of advanced things. So, you know, we'll spend 100 million quid supporting some electric car battery factory that goes absolutely nowhere, but we won't give money to people producing mattresses and chairs and textiles and other things, which we actually know how to make, which we, if given the correct support, could create significantly more value around. You know, the idea also, if those people making simple things, or clothes, chairs, whatever it happens to be, they still have to be advanced manufacturers, even if they're not making an advanced thing. You know, you can't make pencils in the modern world if you aren't a really, really good modern manufacturer. You know, this idea that simple products are not advanced in their manufacture is again, just shows a lack of understanding from those people making policy. You know, we need to support those industries. We need to remind people that these are good jobs and will be jobs for the long term. I mean, I think we've broken all those family bonds again, where, you know, children would follow parents into manufacturing careers. Those bonds have sort of disappeared. And we've taken away all of the opportunity for young people to have a go at making things at school, which is, again, a desperate, massive mistake. You know, it's not just that being able to have a go at, you know, pottery and woodwork and metalwork and textiles and all sorts of things at school produce people who want to go into those industries. Much, much more broadly, it's creating an opportunity to develop young people's creativity, which can lead to developments in science, in engineering, in business, in finance, in all sorts of other ways. Creating creative thinkers doesn't just create creative people working in, you know, creative industries. Yeah. It creates economic value that is way, way, way broader. And I think over the last couple of centuries, we have benefited enormously as a nation from the incredible creativity in all of those fields that I've just mentioned of individuals, both natively British and otherwise. And I think removing from school the opportunity to play and have fun, I think, is a massive problem. The second thing that it does also is that it significantly reduces the chance of an individual young person leaving school and having something that they know that they're good at. You know, if our education is purely academic, many, 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 many people will leave school thinking that they're good at nothing. And that is a total waste of talent. So I think, you know, it's very short-sighted not to be investing in creative education for all sorts of reasons. And also it makes school a lot less fun.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, you talk about the education system. I mean, you know, polytechnics becoming universities doesn't really make sense.
Colleges disappearing, all of this stuff, you know. Also, these are things we are genuinely very good at. Yeah. You know, we have to recognise what we're good at and support what we're good at, not try and do the things that other people are good at just because we think they look sexier and fancier.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I suppose I went to school and we had woodwork and metalworking, home economics.
Home ec.
Yeah. All that stuff.
But did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. I can't think of anyone who didn't enjoy.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there were some, but.
Macaroni cheese.
Yeah. You know, cooking stuff at school, that's good fun. You know, making, I mean, we made, I remember making a bookcase.
Yeah, me too.
At woodwork. That was bloody good fun. I can't remember what I did in metalwork.
I made a die.
Made lots of pots. I was very into pottery at school.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I looked forward to the days at school. I was like, right, we've got this today and I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I was good at maths and physics and chemistry. Mm. But I didn't. I wasn't like I was going in, skipping into school, going Yahoo, physics today. But on the days when it was, you know, with days when it was pottery, I was like, can't wait. And that's, you know, you've got to have more of that at school.
Yeah. And there isn't. I mean,
I know.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, I do quite a bit of work still with schools and. Wherever it's people doing stuff like this, it's usually a particular teacher who off their own bat has taken, you know, the opportunity to do it sort of at lunchtime or after school. Some schools still have a bit of it. I'm doing a project at the moment with design tech to try and get more people studying that at school because numbers are dropping off. But if you don't make people think that that's the route to a great life and career and life, then why are people going to choose it? If you say, you know, we need you all to be developing AI, then everyone's just going to want to sit and do computer science and maths and physics all day. And you know, but not everybody can do that. You know, we've all got different skills and minds and abilities. And, you know, school needs to find the thing that everybody's good at.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about luxury. We've touched on, you know, luxury brands and making and craft. And do you think everything can be luxury?
No. I mean, patently, there's 99% of all the stuff people buy today is far from luxury. I mean, I think there's physical luxury, sort of tangible luxury. And I think much more nowadays also, it's worth thinking about the idea of sort of emotional luxury. Because if you buy something and in the back of your mind is this gnawing sense that somehow it's bad in some way, it doesn't really matter what it is. You know, that doesn't feel good. I think, you know, for something to be a genuine luxury, it has to come without any of that badness that is attached to so many things today, you know, whether it's that the founder is somehow a terrible person or, you know, that the way that the product is made is somehow questionable in some part of its sort of supply chain. I think, you know, I think we want more than anything, we want to feel good about the things that we're buying. And in part that comes from the physical quality of the object, but also in part it comes from the sense of sort of emotional well-being that we get by being associated with these businesses. The things they do, the things they say do matter, you know, to a greater or lesser extent than the product itself. So I think, you know, there are lots and lots of things that even where the objects are sort of physically luxurious, you know, there is a lack of integrity or a lack of good behavior within the way that a business operates that makes you feel or might make you feel bad about being associated with it, buying it, using it.
And do you think something that's mass-produced could be defined as luxury? So we see all these luxury brands who are producing all this stuff and telling us it's luxury.
Well, I mean, I think... I don't know. I think you know, there used to be an idea that luxury was in somehow sort of linked with scarcity. And in that sense, you know, if you're producing and selling your luxury, you know, coated canvas bag in 1,000 locations around the world and you're producing it in factories in enormous numbers, you know, then it starts to become, you know, it's far from scarce. Is it still luxury? Well, again, because today a large part of what constitutes that sense of luxury is the intangible as well as the tangible, then you could probably argue that it maybe is. I mean, I'm not a fan of it. As I've said, I think the object itself should constitute the greater part of, you know, the creation of the object, the making of that object should constitute the greater part of its cost. Mm. If it starts to get to the point where 80% of the cost is intangible stuff, then, you know, I think we're moving away from something that's genuinely luxury. And again, I think that is why, I don't know, when I look at the price of a Chanel bag, it's definitely the percentage of make out of the, you know, that final price tag is definitely, you know, I'd be interested to see their breakdown. But they are still making a genuinely, genuinely good product. Mm. I don't know, I find like the price thing, I think you can be luxury at, you know, I think we make really luxurious clothes. I mean, the fact is we're actually making our, you know, a lot of our stuff in the same factories and from the same materials as some incredibly expensive brands. Mm. And we are not expensive. And, you know, buying our stuff comes with a sense of emotional well-being, you know, that a lot of these brands, you know, people are starting to question that. But I don't know. I mean, it will be different. You know, luxury, I guess, has to be some, you know, there's got to be a sort of, you know, a personal calculation done. I think the other interesting thing about having lost a practical kind of making education from school is that we've lost the tools to discern good quality from bad quality, physical good quality from physical bad quality. You know, we don't know what good materials feel like. If, you know, there are many people growing up that will only ever have worn synthetic clothes. You know, and interesting, I did a documentary for the BBC about making the uniform for the coronation. And one of the officers in one of the household divisions was telling me about some of their new recruits coming in and trying on their uniforms for the first time. And the absolute astonishment in their faces when they pull on a pair of leather boots for the first time. And he was like, some of these people have just only ever worn trainers. They've never worn anything made from leather. They've never worn a coat made from wool. The weight and of the great coats, they're like, what is this stuff? Yeah. They're like, this is quality stuff. So again, I think the removal, you know, how do we as consumers make good, judgments on the quality of objects when we've had our ability to recognize that quality sort of taken away from us. Mm. And again, it leads to us making bad decisions, wasting our money, spending more on stuff than we ought to, because we're just ill-equipped to make sound judgments.
And you talk a lot about happiness and how buying well brings you happiness as opposed to buying lots of stuff which doesn't.
Yeah.
And you have lots of reference points, whether they kind of literary figures, I don't know, Sylvia Plath, I think you mentioned. You talk about Marx and you talk about...
I was all over the place in the research for this book.
Yeah, there was a lot of it.
I do, because I think increasingly, you know, one of the reasons I think why we got involved with being consumers of fashion was to try and make ourselves feel good.
Yeah.
You know, we were spending money for enjoyment. You know, we were spending money not because we needed another wool coat or quilted handbag, but because we enjoyed doing that and it made us happy. And I think for years and years and years, that continued to be a source of happiness. Going to, you know, going to Selfridges or, you know, one of these great department stores and walking around and having, you know, when department stores first came about, you know, they were, for people who didn't live lives of luxury, they were, you know, smells and sights and sounds and literally all of those things. They had orchestras playing in department stores and, you know, they were filled with fresh flowers and amazing fruits and windows. But I mean, it was all part of being sort of entertainment and it was all there to increase our happiness and sense of well-being. But as time has gone on, that has been eroded and that has been replaced by a mechanism of marketing to us that actually is trying to undermine our happiness as a means of trying to encourage us to buy more. Mm. You know, you cannot feel good or happy if you do not have this latest thing, this new thing, this it thing. You know, making people feel insecure about themselves in an attempt to make them buy more is really bad. And I think that is unfortunately quite a lot of how stuff is marketed to us now. And I think the things that actually make us happiest, I mean, there are things that make us happy. You know, there's lots of research that's been done on happiness and there's lots of, you know, there's lots of recording now of our levels of happiness as individuals and as nations. And the interesting thing is the more stuff we have in some, you know, there is no correlation between the amount of stuff we have and the amount of wealth we have and the and our amount of happiness. You know, in fact, in America, where they've been measuring happiness for the longest, they've got inconsiderably more wealthy, but are actually less happy than they were 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the things that make us happy are simple things like chatting to our mates, hanging out with our family, going for a walk with the dog, watching the birds, you know,
tweet
in the garden,
yeah,
walking up a hill and, you know, looking at the view. That's the sort of stuff, listening to music. Lots of really, really simple things that don't cost money. Those are the things that make us happy. And I think the things that we find greatest happiness in are not the things that we've most recently acquired. They tend to be the things that we've had the longest and most richly storied history with. Mm. You know, the things I love most, that I cherish most, are mostly things that either I've had for a very long time, or I have inherited from my dad or my grandparents. You know, whether they're objects in my house that I got from my granny, bits of clothing that I got from my dad or my granddad. Those things are the things that are most special to me, and they're most special because they have inherited a life and a spirit. We used to actually think that our clothes did inherit our spirit. So, you know, that's why we used to put old shoes in the walls of buildings to bring them good luck. But the objects that I like most and that bring me most happiness are the objects whose story I understand, whether it's the story of their creation, you know, the mug that, yeah, I talk about right at the very beginning.
The cookie jar.
The cookie jar that I made for my mother, or pieces of clothing that have lived with me or that were, you know, were important parts of my dad's wardrobe, and I, you know, I can picture my dad wearing these things. I mean, I wore, there's a tie of his that I still wear that I talk about quite a bit, but you know, I remember him wearing that tie. I remember how he looked. I remember how it, you know, how we were, you know, we lived at that time. And when I wear that tie, it sort of takes me back and brings back lots of very happy and positive memories. That stuff makes us happy. You know, things that we have real connections to, you know, whether it's because it's made in Bolton and we're from Bolton, or it's, you know, it's knitted in Hoyk and our grandparents were from Hoyk, or we know the maker, or we've lived with it and we've personally fixed it and darned it. I'm doing a thing over here in a couple of days' time with Celia Pym about, you know, the joy of fixing things. You know, every time you repair something, you put something of yourself into it and it becomes more valuable and it makes you really happy. And I think that is a source of happiness that so many people have forgotten about or have never known about, because they've always been in a world where buying new stuff constantly rather than buying good things and living with them has been the way that they've been encouraged to live. And I think that's really bad.
Mm. The whole Japanese thing around kind of, you know, mending is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they've got, you know, the most valuable objects that that nation has created are the ones that have been broken and fixed again. You know, it's, and I think we are starting to see that. We are starting to see, you know, it's about care. It's about loving objects and caring for those objects. And the more you put into them, the more you get back from them. And that's, you know, I'm not advocating at all for people spending less money. I'm advocating for people choosing with real care where they spend their money and what they spend their money on, because, you know, we can choose to do really good things with the money that we spend. We can choose for it to go into the pockets of people that we'd like it to go into the pockets of, or we can carry on doing things the easy way or the quick way and just give all of our money to a load of billionaire global oligarchs.
Yeah, who don't need any more of it.
Well, they don't need any more of it, and they're not doing anything nice with it anyway. No. So screw them. Yeah. Give it to the nice guys instead.
I mean, I think I'm struck by what you were saying about factories. I've spent time in the factories that you mentioned in Hoyk, and I've spent quite a bit of time on Harris working kind of with...
Yeah, where that tweed was made.
Yeah, exactly. We're quite fortunate because we have access to seeing how things are made and being environments where, you know, you do appreciate things because you can tell the difference.
Yeah.
It's how do you take people on that journey?
I know, it is, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I think we just have to keep telling the stories. I think people are seeking more connection in life. I think the more we become sort of pulled into our digital devices and that kind of digital world, I think the more we need a counterpoint to that that feels real. Mm. And, you know, knowing the weaver and standing in the weaving shed and looking out over the Macaire at the, you know, the turquoise sea on the Isle of Harris makes you feel great when you wear that jacket. Yeah. I'm sure of it. Yeah. It certainly would me. And that stuff is the stuff that's going to not only make us feel happier, but it's going to restore the health of the planet and deal with the inequalities that we're increasingly seeing. Certainly wealth inequality could be reduced by just putting our money where we want it to go, to people that we feel deserve it. And those are people who've learned to do something amazing, who've nurtured a skill, who've trained, who are dedicated, who care deeply about things. That's where I want my money to go.
I think I'm going to end this by asking you, what is your luxury?
Well, my luxury, I'm not prepared for this question. I think my luxury, I think, is making things for myself. Mostly at the moment, that's things for my garden. I am sort of restoring a garden that was once wonderful, and I'm sort of mostly doing it with things that I like, bits of wood that I'm finding and whittling and carving and assembling in a very crude way. But the time that I get to spend sort of creating something lovely out of my garden is the thing that gives me greatest pleasure. And so that's what I reckon is my greatest luxury. It's the time to do something real and fulfilling and rewarding.
Brilliant. Really inspiring chat, Patrick. Thank you so much for joining me on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick, for joining us. And thank you for tuning in. And don't forget, you can listen to all the previous episodes of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast on your favorite platform. And don't forget to subscribe and tune in to our YouTube channel.